But we have this treasure in clay jars so that it may be made clear that this extraordinary power belongs to God and does not come from us. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be made visible in our bodies. For while we live, we are always given up to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus may be made visible in our mortal flesh. So death is at work in us, but life in you. So we do not lose heart, even though our outer nature is wasting away, our inner nature is being renewed day by day. For this slight momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all measure, because we do not look at what can be seen, but at what cannot be seen. For what can be seen is temporary, but what cannot be seen is eternal. God bless this reading.
Well, as our youth make their way out and our Spanish speakers make their way out of the room here, I'd like to take a moment to invite you to stand and greet one another and welcome one another in the name of Jesus. Welcome one another, would you? We enjoy very much the warmth and fellowship and opportunities to connect with one another today, and we're glad that you're here today to share in this time of worship and learning and this assembly. Well, of all of the questions that this series that we're in, called Empty Spaces, all the questions that we're looking at, we called it Tough Questions in Christian Faith, I think was the subtitle for this series. I think that today's question is the toughest of them all. One of the greatest tests a faith system can take on is the question about human suffering. How do we handle that? Some people want to explain it away. Some seek to find out the cause of suffering. If we could just figure out the reason why, then everything we think will take its place. Others simply use the reality of suffering to develop a faith system that places the emphasis of our lives on the sheer random weirdness of life. And the question comes up, from the Christian point of view, how does Christianity stack up against the various ways of thinking about the problem of suffering? For many, it is this problem and this problem alone that creates a real obstacle for belief in God, in the goodness of a being that could possibly allow for human suffering to take place. And in particular, the last 3 centuries or so, theistic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, have faced a particularly difficult challenge on this point. It's interesting, I just have to point out, I'm going off my notes already here, that the problem of suffering in Christian faith is a decidedly modern thing. It happened actually, and to get back onto my notes, when David Hume, the Scottish philosopher, raised this question in kind of a classic sort of formation that set things up that have led for the last 3 centuries to a deep wrestling about all of this. I have a slide that points out 3 statements, 3 affirmations that we've been wrestling with for about 300 years or so. That God is all-powerful. Christians believe that. That God is all-loving. Christians believe that. And that there is suffering and evil in the world. And Christians believe that. The problem comes that Hume and many others since then have worked with is that when you take all 3 of these statements, they all 3 cannot, so the argument goes, stand together. That's the dilemma. If you want to hear it in a little different sort of way, Archibald MacLeish, in his play called J.B., it was his story of the story of Job, says it this way: if God is God, he's not good in light of suffering. And if God is good, he's not God. You can't have it both ways. That's the dilemma we face. Well, this dilemma, as it's presented to us, highlights the problem of suffering and evil, that it's not only an existential question about the meaning of life, but it's a personal, moral thing as well. How do we deal with the deep pain that suffering brings in our lives? And how do we deal with it in the more intellectual sort of realm of thinking about the possibilities of, does God exist and how does God work in our world? But before we go any further with this, I need to say something else about this problem. It is not simply a Christian problem, this problem of suffering and evil. The problem of evil is not merely something that people of religious faith must face. No matter what you believe or don't believe, you still have to deal with the problem of evil. You can't just set it aside by saying, well, there is no God and we live in kind of a random sort of world. Evil is a part of the world's infrastructure, and you're going to have to deal with it in some way or another. This world is not a picnic. Philosopher David Bentley Hart, Eastern Orthodox philosopher who is quite visible on the world stage in some of these kinds of issues, stated in a book published after the 2005 tsunami that killed over 250,000 persons. It's not that long ago, about 6 years ago. Wrote this. He said, evil is not a problem for Christians. He takes a rather remarkable stand there on this point. He says it is a problem for atheists and agnostics. Tsunamis are not a problem for Christians. It's a problem, however, for sentimental liberals who believe in the goodness of Mother Earth. Recently, he goes on to say, I was debating on radio a Dutch member of the European Parliament who described herself on air as, quote, an atheist who has values. She then described her values as caring about this earth and protecting it and passing it on to my children. Bentley Hart goes on to say, I respect and admire her choice. At that moment, though, she probably was not thinking about this murderous tsunami and other natural furies, such as the raging seas that would overpower her own country, Holland, if the extensive huge dikes did not prevent it, nor about diseases that for millennia have kept the primitive population on Earth pitifully low. The problem is that this Earth, as Michael Novak would say, the philosopher and diplomat, served as the ambassador to the UN, said, how cruel is our habitat, Earth? It is a cruel thing, this Earth, this world. We're going to have to deal with the problem of its struggle and its reality in some way or another. And in fact, if you take the point of view of saying, if I just jettison God and then I can deal with the world as it stands, I think there are other problems that stem out of that way of thinking. For example, isn't it interesting that almost everyone, believer or non-believer, can agree that there is good and evil in the world, that there's good and bad, that murder is bad, that violence is destructive, that justice is a worthy ideal? The question I want to ask then is, where did we come up with those ideas? By and large, most folk, Christian or non-Christian, believe that people ought not to suffer, they should not be excluded or oppressed or die of hunger and live in freedom. Yet we understand, do we not, from the world of science, the evolutionary mechanism of natural selection, in fact, depends on death, destruction, and violence of the strong against the weak, that nature, in its very nature, is an incredibly ruthless environment. So on what basis does the non-believer judge the natural processes of the world to be unfair and unjust? The world is just doing what it was designed to do. You see, when we begin to say that there are such things as fairness and justice and right and all these other things, we're working with categories that require something beyond ourselves. If you're going to take the point of view to say, I'm an atheist, the best way to understand the world is just simply by jettisoning the idea of God, then you also have to jettison the idea of justice and right and wrong. Because if you live in a purely natural world, then you live in a world the natural world that is characterized by violence and death and destruction. That's the world of science. The world we live in is a dangerous place. So when we begin to work with this business of suffering, and this is my point here, this business of evil, it's a tough one. And you're going to have to deal with the reality of evil and suffering, whether you're a believer or a non-believer. And I want to put to death this notion that somehow or another I can just jettison God and therefore everything looks okay. If you jettison God, then you also have to jettison the matters of justice and injustice and right and wrong. You have to take a point of view that philosophers call nihilism, of absolute meaninglessness in life. And not many people are pure nihilists. Not many at all. Most would take the point of view, if they get into that kind of way of thinking, of the Australian philosopher J.L. Mackey, who would just say, well, we're just going to have to invent an ethical system and impose it upon our natural world. Well, okay, what do you... you then invent goodness and badness and impose it. Well, that seems a little weak to me. Maybe there's a better way to work that all out. But I need to move on. I need to stay to my notes. I need to talk about evil. And I want to say these things about it. How do Christians respond to evil then? Well, I want to say this, first of all, that Christians, a deep and profound Christian response to evil is to say that evil is real. It really does exist. It is a part of the fabric of the world in which we inhabit. We cannot and should not try to minimize it, as all too often Christians do. I am weary. It is one of the most wearisome things that I experience. As I experienced this past week, I was at Christian Towers, called there to be a part of an announcement. One of the members of the staff at Christian Towers died suddenly this past week. A very sad and very tragic event. 48-year-old man, cut down in the middle of his life, with three children, one in college, two in high school. Very sad. And yet, after the announcement and the time together, I had one person come up to me and say, well, I know this is sad, but God wanted that person more than we did, and so God took him. And I want to scream out, no! God is sad too. There is a thing called evil and suffering, and we need to admit it. God is big enough, I think, to handle that. God did not want to take this man away from his wife and his three children. No, we have to just simply acknowledge the reality that evil is in this world. And suffering is a part of what we live in and have to work with. This business of evil is very much a part of our world, and Christians should be willing to admit and acknowledge that evil is present among us, and we should not try to minimize it. That's why we read in Scripture such things and hear such things as the fact that God, for example, in the Gospel of John, comes into a world that He made, John chapter 1, and yet that world is hostile to Him, John chapter 1. He was in the world, and the world was made by Him, and the world knew Him not. That His appearance within the cosmos is both an act of judgment and rescue of the beauties of creation from the torments of fallen nature. That is why we'll hear the Apostle Paul say things that echo this reality of the broken, frustrated, declining, troublesome world we live in, where he says that the whole creation groans in anguished anticipation of the day when God will bring His glory and change all things, Romans chapter 8. You see, we live with the reality of evil in this world. And we should not back away from acknowledging it. Again, David Bentley Hart would say in his work following the tsunami, a book called The Doors of the Sea, He said this, when confronted with the sheer savage immensity of worldly suffering, when we see the entire literal rim of the Indian Ocean strewn with tens of thousands of corpses, a third of them children's corpses, no Christian is licensed to utter odious banalities about God's inscrutable counsels or blasphemous suggestions that all this mysteriously serves God's good ends. We are permitted only to hate death and waste and the imbecile forces of nature that shatter living souls, to believe that creation is in agony in its bonds, to see this world is divided between two kingdoms, knowing all the while that it is only charity that can sustain us against fate, and that we must do so until the end of days. No, the first thing that Christians do is admit the reality that yes, evil is real. It exists in this world, and we have to reckon with it. The second thing that I would say that would help us with this, and I need the second slide up to kind of work through this. You remember what we said earlier? These affirmations that God is all-loving, that He's all-knowing, that there is suffering and evil in the world. The problem we have with those three statements is that they're not complete. We need a little more. And I'm going to make a claim this morning that may seem surprising and hard. I know it's hard. I've been wrestling with it for 30 years, but I've been wrestling with it this past week immensely. But here it is. An all-loving and all-powerful God cannot eliminate suffering. This is the claim that I am presenting to you this morning. To say that God is all-loving and all-powerful does not necessarily mean that He can do everything there can be done about suffering. This is where we step forward into some new territory. The reason why we have trouble with this statement, some of you are looking at that statement now and saying, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. I think the reason why it doesn't make sense to us is that we don't fully reckon with what it means to say that God is omnipotent or all-powerful. We don't fully recognize what it means to say that God is all-loving. So let me explore this a little bit with you. It is an important question to ask about omnipotence, or that's just the big word for saying that God knows everything, or is all-powerful, actually, would be the better way of saying that. Well, here it is. To say that God is omnipotent sounds like we're saying that God can do anything. However, I have a surprise for you this morning. Actually, it does not mean that God can do anything He likes. Once God chooses to do certain things, or to behave in a certain manner, in a certain way, then other things become excluded. If you choose to say that God can give a creature free will, and at the same time suggest that God should step in and protect people from the consequences of that free will, then you have succeeded in saying absolutely nothing. Or as Alistair McGrath would say, that meaningless combinations of words do not suddenly acquire a meaning when we prefix them with two other words to say God can. We say nothingness when we say that. If God created human beings and a world that is rooted in the notions of free will, then it precludes Him from having to step in and manipulate or protect the creation and those people from their free will acts. This is how McGrath would say a little more about this. Alistair McGrath, Oxford theologian and scientist. It is no more possible for God than for the weakest of His creatures to carry out both of two mutually exclusive alternatives, not because His power meets an obstacle, but because nonsense means nonsense, even when we talk about God. You can't, on one hand, say that God is powerful and He creates a world that can do whatever, that is free to choose what it wants to do, and then turn around and say, okay, now God, You go in and manipulate and protect people from that which they do. If we're going to believe that God is truly all-powerful and that He created us with free will, then we have to live with the consequences of that deep declaration. And the deep declaration is that if you create a world where all kinds of possibilities can happen, and you create creatures who have the freedom to choose whatever they want to happen, then you also have to live with the consequences of that. And you know what? God has to live with the consequences of that. It's what opens the door to the problem of evil and suffering. C.S. Lewis would work this on out a little more as he thinks about this. He says that suffering cannot be regarded as arising from the lack of God's interest or his power. Far from it. If God creates a material universe and gives creatures freedom of action, suffering follows as a matter of course. Having exercised his omnipotence in creating the universe and endowing his creatures with freedom, he cannot block the outcome of that free universe, which is suffering. Quoting Lewis, he says, "Try to exclude the possibility of suffering, which the order of nature and the existence of free wills involve, and you will find that you've excluded real life itself." Then Lewis goes on to consider the implications of that simple word, goodness. And Lewis wants to press home on this idea of God's goodness or God's love. This means speaking about the natural expression of God's passion for humankind. He says, sometimes, he argues, that we humans, when we think about love, have too shallow of an understanding of it. And so we don't understand what it means to say that God loves the world. Quoting Lewis, he says, "Love is not the senile benevolence that drowsily wishes you to be happy in your own way, nor the cold philanthropy of a conscientious magistrate, nor the care of a host who feels himself responsible for the comfort of a guest, but it is God's consuming fire itself." What he's saying is that the love of God is not some sort of happy-go-lucky outlook on life, which makes hedonism its goal. God's love is divine love that proceeds from God and leads back to God, which embraces suffering as a consequence of the greater gifts of life and freedom. Real life implies suffering. And were God to take away suffering from us, he would take away the precious gift of life itself. Again, Lewis would say, "The problem of reconciling human suffering with the existence of God, who loves, is insoluble only so long as we attach a trivial meaning to the word love and look on things as if man were the center of things." When we talk about God's love, we are discovering, what we will discover, is that God's love and the idea of love itself from God's point of view includes the idea of suffering. How can we exclude it? To pull suffering out of the world would divest any notion of what God's love looks like altogether. I'll say more about that, but there's still one other thing that needs to be said before I move forward to talk about God's love. And that is about evil itself a little more. And we talk about God creating a world where there is freedom and this business about the evil and suffering in the world. What does that look like? And how does it function in our world? And how do we get a handle on this business of evil and all of that? And I have to say that I really don't know. The why of evil, fully, is something that stands beyond, I think, any reasoned explanation. It is why Pat said at the table, I think, that we find very little about the suffering of Jesus in the New Testament. And in fact, throughout the pages of Scripture, from Genesis to Revelation, you will never, ever, anywhere find an address to the why of suffering. So the why of it all fully stands outside of our ability to know. I can approximate a guess because some of you want to know why. And so let me give you a little inkling of what I think might be some help, possibly. In the 1880s, there was a French fellow who came up with an idea that has now come to be known as chaos theory. Now, I'm going to talk about this. I need to say this, chaos theory. Some of you are going to hear what I say and say, that just doesn't make any sense at all. And I'm going to say, well, duh, I told you that there's no real reason, no way to explain suffering. Chaos theory has developed through the 20th century, and most notably in the work of an MIT scientist, a meteorologist at MIT in the 1960s, a guy by the name of Edward Lorenz, who's not exactly a household name. But what he did was, in working out models for how weather patterns develop, discovered, or reworked with this idea of chaos theory, that discovered that infinitesimally small changes, we're talking about infinitesimally small changes, in what he entered into his computer about weather patterns would change things drastically. You change the temperature by 1 degree, and 3 days later you have a very different outcome in weather models. It came out to be what is called the butterfly effect. And the way to describe this that is often used is to talk about it this way, that the flutter of a butterfly's wings in the Amazon can actually alter the course of a tornado in Texas. I know you're going, I don't believe it. I told you you wouldn't believe it. But that's chaos theory. That something as small and infinitesimal as a butterfly floating its wings creates echoes and potentialities that can change the weather 3,000 miles away or 5,000 miles away. Chaos theory. Now, this is not the sort of thing that shows up on the evening news generally, but serious scientists take it seriously. And serious philosophers are working with chaos theory to understand something of what is going on in our world and why things happen the way they do. Things so small and infinitesimal that we can hardly see do seem, it so it seems, have impact in ways that we cannot predict. How many of you have ever said while watching the weather on the evening news go, well, like that'll happen? We know how unpredictable all of this is. Even with all kinds of equipment, the idea of predicting the weather is still an unpredictable thing. Why? Because there are simply an infinite number of variables that are at work. And I got to say to you, in this world, there are an infinite number of variables that are at work in our lives, in our interactions, in the earth, in tectonic plates that lie thousands of miles underneath the surface of the earth, in molten whatever that molten stuff is that comes out of volcanoes, lava, or whatever it is, whenever it's not out of the volcano, but in the volcano. We live in a world where there is so much going on that we know so little of. Why do we think that we should be able to figure out all the whys of suffering or of evil or of unexplained events? It is why we can go back thousands of years to an ancient document that you find in your Old Testament, a book called Job, where a man suffers, loses his family, loses all of his wealth, loses his health, and there's chapter and chapter and chapter and chapter of material exploring all the reasons why, and the book comes to a crashing end at the end of it where God announces that you're not going to know. It just is. That's the way it is. It's just the way it is. But it is. It is real, this business of uncertainty and unexplained things and of suffering and of hardship and of horrible things. It's just a part of the world we live in. So if I could see the last slide, the thing I want to affirm this morning is that at the end of this conversation, there is a Christian affirmation that brings this all together. We affirm as Christian people that God is all-powerful. We affirm, all-powerful, yes, able to do anything he chooses. And he has done what he chose to do. He created a world that he put into motion, this business of freedom. And with it, perhaps, if these chaos theory people are right, a little bit of chaos. A little bit of stuff that's unpredictable. And he loves us. He loves us fully and completely. And I want to say more about that. We live in a world where there is evil. And because God is all-powerful and has done what he has done, there are some things that he does not do. But here's the last thing, and this is the clincher for us as Christian people. God does not avoid suffering. God himself embraces suffering in his own person through his Son, Jesus Christ. He does not give us a why, but he does give us a how. He does not answer all of our questions about where do we put the blame and what all these questions we ask, why. But he comes alongside of us. He comes and enters into the world of humankind and embraces suffering in his own person through Jesus Christ. That is the distinctive thing about the Christian faith. And I would suggest to you, it is one of the defining factors between Christianity and every other religious tradition. Our response, Christian response to suffering, is to say that God embraces it in himself and walks with us in and through it. And that's why we have this remarkable legacy within the Christian faith of understanding that God understands suffering. He understands it full well. He knows what suffering is like. And in fact, it is suffering and love that are kind of two sides of the same coin for God. Nicholas Wolterstorff, an American philosopher, lost a son tragically in a climbing accident some years ago and wrote a book out of the experience called Lament for a Son. He writes this: God is love. That is why he suffers. To love our suffering world is to suffer. The one who does not see God's suffering does not see his love. So suffering is down in the very center of things, deep down where the meaning is. Suffering is the meaning of our world. For love is meaning, and love suffers. The tears of God are the meaning of history. You see, for Christians, the way we understand love and suffering begins at the cross of Jesus. We begin with the affirmation that God knows exactly what we are experiencing because he has experienced it himself. He has embodied it. William Temple, 19th century Bishop of Canterbury, Archbishop of Canterbury, said it this when talking about these discussions. He said, when people say there cannot be a God of love, because if there was a God of love, he would look upon the world and his heart would break at all that's going on. The Bishop of Canterbury, William Temple, said this. He said, well, he did. He did look upon the world. And that's what the cross is all about. His heart did break because he himself experienced the sense of pain and loss of suffering. James Jones wrote a book some years ago called Why Do People Suffer? And he tells a story in the book about a school, an elementary school that collapsed. It killed all the teachers and killed most of the students. A little boy, badly maimed, was rescued out of the rubble, rushed to the hospital. And there, a team of doctors and nurses fought to save his life while his mother waited anxiously outside the surgery room. And after 7 hours of painstaking surgery, the boy died. The surgeon in charge, instead of leaving it to a nurse or some other staff person to go speak to this anxious mother out in the waiting room, went himself. And as he began to break the dreadful news that her child had died, she became hysterical in her grief. She attacked the surgeon. She began to pummel on his chest with her fists. But instead of pushing her away, the doctor pulled her up against his own chest. And finally, holding her deeply and tightly, the sobbing subsisted, and she rested cradled in his arms. And then a few more moments passed, And in the heavy silence, the surgeon began to weep. Tears streamed down his face, and grief racked his body. For he had come to the hospital the moment he had heard that his one and only son was in that school that morning as well. God knows about suffering. The year after the Oklahoma City bombing occurred in April 19th, 1995, you remember that day? I was in Oklahoma City that day. I flew out of Oklahoma City to Abilene, Texas that morning to defend my doctoral dissertation. Didn't know it when I got on the plane. When I got to Abilene, the flight attendant said, "Do you know what happened in Oklahoma City?" I said, "I have no idea." I flew back 2 days later into Oklahoma City and began to see firsthand all that went on there. My mother was a hospital administrator at Presbyterian Hospital just a few blocks from the scene of the bombing. And so I heard through her about all of the heroic kinds of work that went on. 80 patients seen in 2 hours, the first 2 hours at Presbyterian Hospital, lined walls lined with gurneys of injured and wounded people. The year following, out of that experience, I published an essay in the Indianapolis paper about that event, and I posted it this morning to my blog if you'd like to read it, April 19th, 1996. Indianapolis News. In that, I recounted those events of that day and all of the things that went on that day. And I asked the question, in part, where was God in the middle of all of that? My response then and now is that God was in the preschool center that was on the second floor of the Murrah building that day. He was on the ninth floor of that building that day, present with those whose lives were lost. God was present in the hallways of the Presbyterian Hospital and all of the hospitals in Oklahoma City that day. He was present there. That, my friends, is at the heart of the Christian faith. That is our witness to the problem and the reality of suffering in our world. We do not need to play some sort of mental, philosophical mind games about trying to explain away how God is this, that, or the other, how an all-knowing and all-caring God, and all of the syllogisms that get created in all the philosophical textbooks of the last three centuries. Our affirmation is that God, in and through Jesus Christ, meets us in the place of human where humans find themselves most abandoned. Jesus said it himself on the cross, did he not? My God, why have you forsaken me? And in that moment, Jesus expresses this deep, ironic truth. For you see that even as Jesus said, "Why have you abandoned me?" He's still talking to his Father. Mm-hmm. That is the mystery that we live with. That even in our abandonment and sense of loss and our inability to explain or give voice to what we are experiencing, we believe, as Jesus believed, that God is still present. So that is why Job of old could say, "The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away, blessed be the name of the Lord." That is why Paul could say, as he did in this text we heard read a few moments ago, that even though my body is wasting away, there's something renewing occurring in me. That somehow or another, the experiences of this present time are preparing me for an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comprehension. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 16, 17, and 18. And that is why today, as Christian people, we can live in confidence, not in bravado, not in a certain sense of pride, but in a sense of confidence that God is present to us in all of our experiences. As we close today, we sing a song that I think affirms some of this. And I invite you, as we stand and sing here in a moment, to sing it with strength and with gusto. Do we have it on the screen? Is that where it's on the screen? Okay. So as we sing this morning, and you respond in with your words and with your heart and with your voice this morning, if there's a way in which someone could come alongside of you and be helpful to you as you wrestle with these deep things that we've offered this morning, we invite you to make your way to the front as we stand and sing.